They drew lots for the run. She picked a folded slip of paper from among a pile containing all their names. The winner was not in the room, but he was one of the best men on the system. Pat Logan, engineer of the Taggart Comet on the Nebraska division. "Wire Pat and tell him he's been demoted to a freight," she said to Eddie. She added casually, as if it were a last-minute decision, but it fooled no one. "Oh, yes, tell him that I'm going to ride with him in the cab of the engine on that run." An old engineer beside her grinned and said, "I thought you would, Miss Taggart." Reardon was in New York on the day when Dagny telephoned him from her office. "Hank, I'm going to have a press conference tomorrow." He laughed aloud.
"No."
"Yes." Her voice sounded earnest, but dangerously a bit too earnest. "The newspapers have suddenly discovered me and are asking questions. I'm going to answer them."
"Have a good time."
"I will." "Are you going to be in town tomorrow? I'd like to have you in on it."
"Okay. I wouldn't want to miss it."
The reporters who came to the press conference in the office of the John Galt Line were young men who had been trained to think that their job consisted of concealing from the world the nature of its events. It was their daily duty to serve as audience for some public figure who made utterances about the public good, in phrases carefully chosen to convey no meaning. It was their daily job to sling words together in any combination they pleased, so long as the words did not fall into a sequence saying something specific. They could not understand the interview now being given to them. Dagny Taggart sat behind her desk in an office that looked like a slum basement. She wore a dark blue suit with a white blouse, beautifully tailored, suggesting an air of formal, almost military elegance. She sat straight, and her manner was severely dignified. Just a shade too dignified. Reardon sat in a corner of the room, sprawled across a broken armchair, his long legs thrown over one of its arms, his body leaning against the other. His manner was pleasantly informal, just a bit too informal. In the clear, monotonous voice of a military report, consulting no papers, looking straight at the men, Dagny recited the technological facts about the John Galt Line, giving exact figures on the nature of the rail, the capacity of the bridge, the method of construction, the costs. Then, in the dry tone of a banker, she explained the financial prospects of the line, and named the large profits she expected to make. "That is all," she said.
"All?" said one of the reporters. "Aren't you going to give us a message for the public?"
"That was my message."
"But hell, I mean, aren't you going to defend yourself?"
"Against what?"
"Don't you want to tell us something to justify your line?"
"I have."
A man with a mouth shaped as a permanent sneer asked, "Well, what I want to know, as Bertram Scudder stated, is what protection do we have against your line being no good?"
"Don't ride on it."
Another asked, "Aren't you going to tell us your motive for building that line?"
"I have told you. The profit which I expect to make."
"Oh, Miss Taggart, don't say that,"
cried a young boy. He was new, he was still honest about his job, and he felt that he liked Dagny Taggart without knowing why.
"That's the wrong thing to say. That's what they're all saying about you."
"Are they?"
"I'm sure you didn't mean it the way it sounds, and I'm sure you'll want to clarify it."
"Why, yes, if you wish me to. The average profit of railroads has been 2% of the capital invested. An industry that does so much and keeps so little should consider itself immoral. As I've explained, the cost of the John Galt Line in relation to the traffic which it will carry makes me expect a profit of not less than 15% on our investment. Of course, any industrial profit above 4% is considered usury nowadays. I shall nevertheless do my best to make the John Galt Line earn a profit of 20% for me, if possible. That was my motive for building the line. Have I made myself clear now?" The boy was looking at her helplessly.
"You don't mean to earn a profit for you, Miss Taggart? You mean for the small stockholders, of course," he prompted hopefully.
"Why, no. I happen to be one of the largest stockholders of Taggart Transcontinental, so my share of the profits will be one of the largest. Now, Mr. Reardon is in a much more fortunate position, because he has no stockholders to share with. Or would you rather make your own statement, Mr. Reardon?"
"Yes, gladly," said Reardon. Inasmuch as the formula of Reardon metal is my own personal secret, and in view of the fact that the metal costs much less to produce than you boys can imagine, I expect to skin the public to the tune of a profit of 25% in the next few years.
What do you mean, skin the public, Mr. Reardon? Asked the boy.
If it's true, as I've read in your ads, that your metal will last 3 times longer than any other, and at half the price, wouldn't the public be getting a bargain?
Oh, have you noticed that? Said Reardon.
Do the two of you realize you're talking for publication? Asked the man with the sneer.
But, Mr. Hopkins, said Dagny in polite astonishment, is there any reason why we would talk to you if it weren't for publication?
Do you want us to quote all the things you said?
I hope I may trust you to be sure and quote them. Would you oblige me by taking this down verbatim? She paused to see their pencils ready, then dictated, Miss Taggart says, quote, I expect to make a pile of money on the John Galt line. I will have earned it. Close quote. Thank you so much.
Any questions, gentlemen? Asked Reardon.
There were no questions.
Now I must tell you about the opening of the John Galt line, said Dagny. The first train will depart from the station of Taggart Transcontinental in Cheyenne, Wyoming, at 4 p.m. on July 22nd. It will be a freight special, consisting of 80 cars. It will be driven by an 8,000-horsepower, 4-unit diesel locomotive, which I'm leasing from Taggart Transcontinental for the occasion. It will run nonstop to Wyatt Junction, Colorado, traveling at an average speed of 100 miles per hour. I beg your pardon? She asked, hearing the long, low sound of a whistle.
What did you say, Miss Taggart?
I said 100 miles per hour, grades, curves, and all.
But shouldn't you cut the speed below normal, rather than...
Miss Taggart, don't you have any consideration whatever for public opinion?
But I do. If it weren't for public opinion, an average speed of 65 miles per hour would have been quite sufficient.
Who's going to run that train?
I had quite a bit of trouble about that. All the Taggart engineers volunteered to do it. So did the firemen, the brakemen, and the conductors. We had to draw lots for every job on the train's crew. The engineer will be Pat Logan, of the Taggart Comet. The fireman, Ray McKim. I shall ride in the cab of the engine with them.
Not really.
Please do attend the opening. It's on July 22nd. The press is most eagerly invited. Contrary to my usual policy, I have become a publicity hound.
Really?
I should like to have spotlights, radio microphones, and television cameras. I suggest that you plant a few cameras around the bridge. The collapse of the bridge would give you some interesting shots.
Miss Taggart? Asked Reardon. Why didn't you mention that I'm going to ride in that engine, too?
She looked at him across the room, and for a moment they were alone, holding each other's glance.
Yes, of course, Mr. Reardon, she answered.
She did not see him again until they looked at each other across the platform of the Taggart station in Cheyenne on July 22nd. She did not look for anyone when she stepped out on the platform. She felt as if her senses had merged, so that she could not distinguish the sky, the sun, or the sounds of an enormous crowd, but perceived only a sensation of shock and light. Yet he was the first person she saw, and she could not tell for how long a time he was also the only one. He stood by the engine of the John Galt train, talking to somebody outside the field of her consciousness. He was dressed in gray slacks and shirt. He looked like an expert mechanic. But he was stared at by the faces around him because he was Hank Reardon of Reardon Steel. High above him she saw the letters TT on the silver front of the engine. The lines of the engine slanted back, aimed at space. There was distance and a crowd between them, but his eyes moved to her the moment she came out. They looked at each other and she knew that he felt as she did. This was not to be a solemn venture upon which their future depended, but simply their day of enjoyment. Their work was done. For the moment there was no future. They had earned the present. Only if one feels immensely important, she had told him, can one feel truly light. Whatever the train's run would mean to others, for the two of them, their own persons, were this day's sole meaning. Whatever it was that others sought in life,
Their right to what they now felt was all the two of them wished to find. It was as if across the platform they said it to each other. Then she turned away from him. She noticed that she too was being stared at, that there were people around her, that she was laughing and answering questions. She had not expected such a large crowd. They filled the platform, the tracks, the square beyond the station. They were on the roofs of the boxcars on the sidings, at the windows of every house in sight. Something had drawn them here, something in the air which, at the last moment, had made James Taggart want to attend the opening of the John Galt line. She had forbidden it. "If you come, Jim," she had said, "I'll have you thrown out of your own Taggart station. This is one event you're not going to see." Then she had chosen Eddie Willers to represent Taggart Transcontinental at the opening. She looked at the crowd, and she felt simultaneously astonishment that they should stare at her when this event was so personally her own that no communication about it was possible, and a sense of fitness that they should be here, that they should want to see it, because the sight of an achievement was the greatest gift a human being could offer to others. She felt no anger toward anyone on earth. The things she had endured had now receded into some outer fog, like pain that still exists but has no power to hurt. Those things could not stand in the face of this moment's reality. The meaning of this day was as brilliantly, violently clear as the splashes of sun on the silver of the engine. All men had to perceive it now. No one could doubt it, and she had no one to hate. Eddie Willers was watching her. He stood on the platform surrounded by Taggart executives, division heads, civic leaders, and the various local officials who had been out-argued, bribed, or threatened to obtain permits to run a train through town zones at 100 miles an hour. For once, for this day and event, his title of vice president was real to him, and he carried it well. But while he spoke to those around him, his eyes kept following Dagny through the crowd. She was dressed in blue slacks and shirt. She was unconscious of official duties. She had left them to him. The train was now her sole concern, as if she were only a member of its crew. She saw him, she approached, and she shook his hand. Her smile was like a summation of all the things they did not have to say. "Well, Eddie, you're Taggart Transcontinental now." "Yes," he said solemnly, his voice low. There were reporters asking questions, and they dragged her away from him. They were asking him questions, too. "Mr. Willers, what is the policy of Taggart Transcontinental in regard to this line?"
"So Taggart Transcontinental is just a disinterested observer, is it, Mr. Willers?"
He answered as best he could. He was looking at the sun on a diesel engine, but what he was seeing was the sun in a clearing of the woods, and a 12-year-old girl telling him that he would help her run the railroad someday. He watched from a distance while the train's crew was lined up in front of the engine to face a firing squad of cameras. Dagny and Reardon were smiling, as if posing for snapshots of a summer vacation. Pat Logan, the engineer, a short, sinewy man with graying hair and a contemptuously inscrutable face, posed in a manner of amused indifference. Ray McKim, the fireman, a husky young giant, grinned with an air of embarrassment and superiority together. The rest of the crew looked as if they were about to wink at the cameras. A photographer said, laughing, "Can't you people look doomed, please? I know that's what the editor wants." Dagny and Reardon were answering questions for the press. There was no mockery in their answers now, no bitterness. They were enjoying it. They spoke as if the questions were asked in good faith. Irresistibly, at some point which no one noticed, this became true. "What do you expect to happen on this run?" a reporter asked one of the brakemen. "Do you think you'll get there?"
"I think we'll get there," said the brakeman. "And so do you, brother."
"Mr. Logan, do you have any children? Did you take out any extra insurance? I'm just thinking of the bridge, you know."
"Don't cross that bridge till I come to it," Pat Logan answered contemptuously.
"Mr. Reardon, how do you know that your rail will hold?"
"The man who taught people to make a printing press," said Reardon.
"How did he know it?" "Tell me, Miss Taggart, what's going to support a 7,000-ton train on a 3,000-ton bridge?"
"My judgment," she answered.
The men of the press, who despised their own profession, did not know why they were enjoying it today. One of them, a young man with years of notorious success behind him, and a cynical look of twice his age, said suddenly, "I know what I'd like to be. I wish I could be a man who covers news." The hands of the clock on the station building stood at 3:45. The crew started off toward the caboose at the distant end of the train. The movement and noise of the crowd were subsiding. Without conscious intention, people were beginning to stand still. The dispatcher had received word from every local operator along the line of rail that wound through the mountains to the Wyatt oil fields, 300 miles away. He came out of the station building, and looking at Dagny, gave the signal for clear track ahead. Standing by the engine, Dagny raised her hand, repeating his gesture in sign of an order received and understood. The long line of boxcars stretched off into the distance, in spaced rectangular lengths like a spinal cord. When the conductor's arm swept through the air, far at the end, she moved her arm in answering signal. Reardon, Logan, and McKim stood silently as if at attention, letting her be first to get aboard. As she started up the rungs on the side of the engine, a reporter thought of a question he had not asked. "Miss Taggart," he called after her, "who is John Galt?" She turned, hanging onto a metal bar with one hand, suspended for an instant above the heads of the crowd. "We are," she answered. Logan followed her into the cab, then McKim. Reardon went last. Then the door of the engine was shut, with the tight finality of sealed metal. The lights hanging on a signal bridge against the sky were green. There were green lights between the tracks, low over the ground, dropping off into the distance where the rails turned and a green light stood at the curve, against leaves of a summer green that looked as if they too were lights. Two men held a white silk ribbon stretched across the track in front of the engine. They were the superintendent of the Colorado division and Neely's chief engineer, who had remained on the job. Eddie Willers was to cut the ribbon they held and thus to open the new line. The photographers posed him carefully, scissors in hand, his back to the engine. He would repeat the ceremony two or three times, they explained, to give them a choice of shots. They had a fresh bolt of ribbon ready. He was about to comply, then stopped. "No," he said suddenly, "it's not going to be a phony." In a voice of quiet authority, the voice of a vice president, he ordered, pointing at the cameras, "Stand back, way back. Take one shot when I cut it, then get out of the way, fast." They obeyed, moving hastily farther down the track. There was only 1 minute left. Eddie turned his back to the cameras and stood between the rails facing the engine. He held the scissors ready over the white ribbon. He took his hat off and tossed it aside. He was looking up at the engine. A faint wind stirred his blonde hair. The engine was a great silver shield bearing the emblem of Nat Taggart. Eddie Willers raised his hand as the hand of the station clock reached the instant of 4. "Open her up, Pat," he called. In the moment when the engine started forward, he cut the white ribbon and leaped out of the way. From the sidetrack, he saw the window of the cab go by and Dagny waving to him in an answering salute. Then the engine was gone, and he stood looking across at the crowded platform that kept appearing and vanishing as the freight cars clicked past him. The green-blue rails ran to meet them like two jets shot out of a single point beyond the curve of the earth. The cross ties melted as they approached into a smooth stream rolling down under the wheels. A blurred streak clung to the side of the engine low over the ground. Trees and telegraph poles sprang into sight abruptly and went by as if jerked back. The green plane stretched past in a leisurely flow. At the edge of the sky, a long wave of mountains reversed the movement and seemed to follow the train. She felt no wheels under the floor. The motion was a smooth flight on a sustained impulse, as if the engine hung above the rails, riding a current. She felt no speed. It seemed strange that the green lights of the signals kept coming at them and past every few seconds. She knew that the signal lights were spaced 2 miles apart. The needle on the speedometer in front of Pat Logan stood at 100. She sat in the fireman's chair and glanced across at Logan once in a while. He sat slumped forward a little relaxed, one hand resting lightly on the throttle as if by chance. But his eyes were fixed on the track ahead. He had the ease of an expert, so confident that it seemed casual. But it was the ease of a tremendous concentration, the concentration on one's task that has the ruthlessness of an absolute. Ray McKim sat on a bench behind them. Reardon stood in the middle of the cab. He stood hands in pockets, feet apart, braced against the motion, looking ahead. There was nothing he could now care to see by the side of the track. He was looking at the rail. Ownership, she thought, glancing back at him. Weren't there those who knew nothing of its nature and doubted its reality? No, it was not made of papers, seals, grants, and permissions. There it was, in his eyes. The sound filling the cab seemed part of the space they were crossing. It held the low drone of the motors, the sharper clicking of the many parts that rang in varied cries of metal, and the high, thin chimes of trembling glass panes. Things streaked past. A water tank, a tree, a shanty, a grain silo. They had a windshield wiper motion. They were rising, describing a curve, and dropping back. The telegraph wires ran a race with the train, rising and falling from pole to pole in an even rhythm, like the cardiograph record of a steady heartbeat written across the sky. She looked ahead at the haze that melted rail and distance, a haze that could rip apart at any moment to some shape of disaster. She wondered why she felt safer than she had ever felt in a car behind the engine, safer here where it seemed as if should an obstacle rise, her breast and the glass shield would be first to smash against it. She smiled, grasping the answer. It was the security of being first, with full sight and full knowledge of one's course, not the blind sense of being pulled into the unknown by some unknown power ahead. It was the greatest sensation of existence, not to trust, but to know. The glass sheets of the cab's windows made the spread of the field seem vaster. The earth looked as open to movement as it was to sight. Yet nothing was distant, and nothing was out of reach. She had barely grasped the sparkle of a lake ahead, and in the next instant she was beside it, then past. It was a strange foreshortening between sight and touch, she thought, between wish and fulfillment, between... The words clicked sharply in her mind after a startled stop. Between spirit and body. First the vision, then the physical shape to express it. First the thought, then the purposeful motion down the straight line of a single track to a chosen goal. Could one have any meaning without the other? Wasn't it evil to wish without moving, or to move without aim? Whose malevolence was it that crept through the world, struggling to break the two apart and set them against each other? She shook her head. She did not want to think or to wonder why the world behind her was as it was. She did not care. She was flying away from it, at the rate of 100 miles an hour. She leaned to the open window by her side and felt the wind of the speed blowing her hair off her forehead. She lay back conscious of nothing but the pleasure it gave her. Yet her mind kept racing. Broken bits of thought flew past her attention like the telegraph poles by the track. Physical pleasure, she thought. This is a train made of steel, running on rails of Reardon metal, moved by the energy of burning oil and electric generators. It's a physical sensation of physical movement through space. But is that the cause and the meaning of what I now feel? Do they call it a low animal joy? This feeling that I would not care if the rail did break to bits under us now? It won't, but I wouldn't care. Because I have experienced this. A low, physical, material, degrading pleasure of the body? She smiled, her eyes closed, the wind streaming through her hair. She opened her eyes and saw that Reardon stood looking down at her. It was the same glance with which he had looked at the rail. She felt her power of volition knocked out by some single dull blow that made her unable to move. She held his eyes, lying back in her chair, the wind pressing the thin cloth of her shirt to her body. He looked away, and she turned again to the sight of the earth tearing open before them. She did not want to think, but the sound of thought went on, like the drone of the motors under the sounds of the engine. She looked at the cab around her, the fine steel mesh of the ceiling, she thought, and the row of rivets in the corner holding sheets of steel sealed together. Who made them? The brute force of men's muscles? Who made it possible for four dials and three levers in front of Pat Logan to hold the incredible power of the 16 motors behind them and deliver it to the effortless control of one man's hand? These things and the capacity from which they came, was this the pursuit men regarded as evil? Was this what they called an ignoble concern with the physical world? Was this the state of being enslaved by matter? Was this the surrender of man's spirit to his body? She shook her head, as if she wished she could toss the subject out of the window and let it get shattered somewhere along the track. She looked at the sun on the summer fields. She did not have to think, because these questions were only details of a truth she knew and had always known. Let them go past like the telegraph poles. The thing she knew was like the wires flying above in an unbroken line. The words for it, and for this journey, and for her feeling, and for the whole of man's earth were, "It's so simple, and so right." She looked out at the country. She had been aware for some time of the human figures that flashed with an odd regularity at the side of the track, but they went by so fast that she could not grasp their meaning, until, like the squares of a movie film, brief flashes blended into a whole, and she understood it. She had had the track guarded since its completion, but she had not hired the human chain she saw strung out along the right-of-way. A solitary figure stood at every milepost. Some were young schoolboys. Others were so old that the silhouettes of their bodies looked bent against the sky. All of them were armed with anything they had found, from costly rifles to ancient muskets. All of them wore railroad caps. They were the sons of Taggart employees and old railroad men who had retired after a full lifetime of Taggart service. They had come unsummoned to guard this train. As the engine went past him, every man in his turn stood erect at attention and raised his gun in a military salute. When she grasped it, she burst out laughing, suddenly with the abruptness of a cry. She laughed, shaking like a child. It sounded like sobs of deliverance. Pat Logan nodded to her with a faint smile. He had noted the guard of honor long ago. She leaned to the open window, and her arms swept in wide curves of triumph, waving to the men by the track. On the crest of a distant hill, she saw a crowd of people, their arms swinging against the sky. The gray houses of a village were scattered through a valley below, as if dropped there once and forgotten. The roof line slanted, sagging, and the years had washed away the color of the walls. Perhaps generations had lived there, with nothing to mark the passage of their days but the movement of the sun from east to west. Now these men had climbed the hill to see a silver-headed comet cut through their plains like the sound of a bugle through a long wait of silence. As houses began to come more frequently, closer to the track, she saw people at the windows, on the porches, on distant roofs. She saw crowds blocking the roads at grade crossings. The roads went sweeping past, like the spokes of a fan, and she could not distinguish human figures, only their arms greeting the train like branches waving in the wind of its speed. They stood under the swinging red lights of warning signals, under the signs saying stop, look, listen. The station past which they flew as they went through a town at 100 miles an hour was a swaying sculpture of people from platform to roof. She caught the flicker of waving arms, of hats tossed in the air, of something flung against the side of the engine, which was a bunch of flowers.